Whiplash.
And I read the script and honestly I was like, yes.
Welcome to the Unlikely Story Podcast. We are here with a good friend and a very talented man, director of photography, cinematographer, Ed Lucas, everybody.
Ed,
how's it going?
How are you, my man?
Good, good. Yeah, long drive up from LA, but loving being here and good to see you guys.
Back in Fresno again.
Good to have you here.
I love Fresno.
A little bit about Ed as a cinematographer. So Ed, you got started in camera department on some big movies, Casino Royale, Atonement. But since then, you've DP'd like what, like 30 feature films,
yeah,
something like that?
Yeah, I'm up to like 30 or 32 now.
Dude, that's insane.
Crazy.
That's insane. Of course, one of those movies was The Gallows, our film, and that's where Ed and us first met. It was actually the reshoots of The Gallows,
because
we had shot a version totally solo.
Yeah, we had a whole original wacky version, and then Blumhouse was like, hey, let's get you some extra hands.
Yeah, give us some help.
Okay, cool.
A little less shaky.
Yeah, a little less shaky. That's right. Yeah. Did you see that original version? You did, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. Yeah, because we were referencing that a lot. And I mean, honestly, you know, we stuck to a lot of the ideas that you guys had there. And then we just tried to kind of like, okay, cool. What can we do to elevate or help? Or like, oh, you know what would be cool here is that we can hide a cut here and we can do a whip here and we can, you know, chase this through.
The original version of the film was operated mostly by the actors. Travis and I would jump in and do a lot too. But then when we did that round of reshoots with you, it was mostly you for the rest of that. I mean, every now and then again, you'd have to kind of hand the camera off to the actors in some of those wonky situations, I remember. But
no, I mean, I always hate giving actors cameras, honestly, because it's not what they're thinking about. You know what I mean? It's sort of stuff. But no, there was a movie that I did called The Speak, which was my first feature, my first full-length feature, my second full-length feature, which was kind of sold as like a one take and similar kind of thing. It was like somebody running around being chased around a hotel by ghosts and, you know, dead people and all that stuff.
I think we had seen part of that.
Yeah. And that was the same kind of concept where it's like they had to film what they were filming themselves, but I don't think they barely even ever touched the camera, because even if they're like, you know, back filming and selfie filming themselves, they usually just have their hand on my hand and I'm making sure that it's framed right, or if it's like down by their side, it's on the floor, or when the camera drops, you drop and make sure it lands, you know, like the Cassidy shot on this one where she's kicking and going away, like that didn't just fall like that so you perfectly see it. Of course we want you to believe that, but that's us. Like,
that was a lot of those tricks that I think we had kind of learned and grew in that second version, you know, finding those tricks and those things with
really elevating them to be just right.
Because it's such a fine line. I joined this like Facebook group. It's like for found footage movies fans, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And I was commenting on something. Someone was like, is there any found footage movie out there where people aren't just like screaming and crazy? And I'm just like, well, just like, found footage is supposed to emulate reality. What do you do when you're scared? You scream, you make noise, you try to not have silence because it's uncomfortable, right? So it's like, but that's the fine line of found footage. You know, it's like the reality and the movie, you know, where's that middle ground?
And also you're making a found footage movie. You're not making a documentary.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So like there's this kind of world where you're, you know, we're telling a story, we're capturing it. And like, it doesn't matter whether or not you have cinematography, you know, based on like Lawrence of Arabia and the big shots or you know, like name any movie, Matrix movie, whatever, where it's really drawn where the audience is really like flashed in the face with cinematography, or you've got something like The Gallows where, you know, if the audience feels like there is no cinematographer, that's even better. Then I've done my job even better, you know?
Right,
and I always joke that like the movie that has made the most money that I've worked on, or that, you know, that I've DP'd, was the movie that, you know, looks the worst. You know what I mean? Or looks like I wasn't involved, you know? But that's exactly what it should be.
But you're totally right. You know? That means you did your job for that story, for that movie perfectly.
Yeah.
Because it should be as though a high school student shot it with no experience, you know?
Like, well, no, exactly. And it should look like that and but give you those feelings, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we put up those lights outside, you know, or, you know, our lighting package was tiny on this, but
super tiny.
But, yeah, just having a couple of practicals, like the red flashing lights, those were lights we put in. Mm-hmm. And then we had the light outside of the school that kind of was meant to feel like a security light.
And I think at first you were like, what is this all about? But like we used some of the AutoZone like LED lights with little 9-volt batteries and like hid them behind certain things.
Yeah, just tuck them behind things.
Tuck them away. Yeah. That's great.
But I mean, that's always the thing as well, is especially when you first start out, like everybody is like, oh, I need this camera and I need these lights and I need this LED dimmer and blah, blah, blah. You don't. Like, you know, make it feel real. Or, you know, I mean, it depends what you're trying to make. If you're trying to make some really high concept thing, you know, sure, you're going to need to spend some time figuring out how to solder and putting LEDs behind things or some spaceship thing or whatever. But, dude, you can do an amazing stuff with stuff that you can buy at Fry's.
Oh, and and I've just this latest phone upgrade, 4K, and I mean, this is more than the cameras we were working with.
Yeah.
For the first round of the Gallows, for sure, the CE300 had some plenty of capability.
Yeah, I want to say that was like, I'm not entirely sure of the specs of when we first shot it, but I know it was one of their first pre-release stuff, and I think it was just 2K. It wasn't even 4K internal or any of that stuff. We didn't use any external recorders.
Or 3K. It was a weird, was it a
something
weird
strange.
3K?
Yeah.
Well, this is kind of a good segue. I mean, Ed, you've worked on a lot of big things, big commercials, a lot of movies, working with a lot of named talent even, which is super cool. You know, Acts of Violence, the Nancy Drew movie. We also just watched the movie you did with Karen Gillan, that was her directorial debut.
Yeah, that was The Party's Just Beginning.
Yeah, that was cool. A lot of cool shots in there. That wonder that opened it up, I really liked. I like that. But going off of this topic of like kind of doing things with very little, speak to that. Like what do you suggest for anyone out there who might be looking to get into cinematography but doesn't have, you know, the expensive camera, they don't have the gear.
They don't have the total package as of yet, so to speak.
What are some, like...
Trust me, you never have the total package. It doesn't matter how much money you have on a show, you always want something more.
Yeah.
a bigger crane, a bigger thing. It doesn't matter. Like, if you have what you need, you probably aren't aiming high enough.
That's a good point.
So you're never going to have it. Trust me, like, doesn't matter any of the budget stuff. Like, the bigger the budget, the more the expectations, the bigger the stuff. Like, it doesn't make any difference. You never have it because you always want or think you need more.
Right. And you even always hear like people on like the behind the scenes features of big movies even. You'll hear the people be like, we had such a small budget, such a tight thing. And it's like, bro, you had like $100 million on that.
You had money flying out your wazoo.
But they're probably referring to exactly what you're talking about. They had tools and things that they wanted that they weren't able to get. Yeah. So they had to make do. What are some examples of that? Like any instances come to mind for you, like where you just had to make do?
Oh yeah, always. I mean, there was a movie that I did with Bill Fichtner. It was actually his directorial debut. For some reason, I always end up doing directorial debuts of actors and stuff. It's kind of always crazy.
Nice.
But we did a movie with him where there's like a Spanish galleon and it's all about, you know, kind of like slaves coming over and all this stuff, and the galleon sinks. So when I read it, it was all set under, you know, like in the deck like in the bowels of the ship, and it's flooding, and I was like, okay, this is going to be awesome. We can really make something cool here, and water rushing in. I've got a bit of a history with the water, so I knew kind of like how we needed to do it how we should have done it. And then I got there and they'd already scouted stuff and they're like, oh yeah, we're just going to build this set and this is how we're going to do it. And I'm like, that's going to look awful. Mm. It's going to look really bad. And we kind of pursued that for about 2 weeks because they'd made all those decisions before they brought me on.
Mm.
And I was like, guys, I don't know. And then what we ended up with, you know, they wanted to do a swimming pool, but I was like, if you're going to build a set in a swimming pool, you're going to have to drain it, but then you're also going to have to put it on tires or something so that you can get some rocking motion, because otherwise the set's going to be static.
Mm.
And then all the water rushing in. So it got to the point where we were like 4 days before, and the pool that we had been kind of entertaining this idea in finally was like, wait, you want it? No, we're not gonna let you do that.
Okay, they didn't realize everything that was gonna happen.
with their pool. Or, you know, productions kind of telling them what they, you know, enough to kind of, you know, get the yes type thing.
Yeah.
And ultimately that never really works. Just be upfront and just be like, okay, paint the worst picture you can and then make them be happy rather than paint like a rosy picture and realize that it's all blood and guts in this room.
Yeah. We always tell everyone that it's going to look like a tornado has come through. But when we're done and gone, it'll look like we were never even there.
Exactly.
That's how you want to. You want to leave things better than the way that you found them. So.
Yeah, but when you walk in and see a flying cow come past, don't get scared. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Oh, you meant a literal tornado. yes, we did.
So ultimately, what we ended up kind of doing at the end of this was. We ended up, needing to be close to a water source, needing some space, and it was all at night, so we had to be able to kind of black it out. So, where do you go for a large amount of water where you can get stuff flowing and things like this? We just went to a firehouse, and they ended up pulling out two of their fire engines, and we ended up shooting this scene. I convinced the director that if he let me put it on the deck of the ship rather than in the bowels of the ship, I can then do like. Wind and lightning, and I can do all these flashes and all this stuff and kind of hide the environment way more than I can if you're underneath where there wouldn't be any rain, there wouldn't be any wind. Maybe you get some drips coming from above, but that's like a whole setup issue in itself.
Yeah.
So we ended up literally building, I think it was a flat actually from one of the walls that we had from the original set. It was maybe 10 feet by 12, maybe 10 by 15. And we literally put it on a kind of 6x6 log, basically, so that we could kind of rock it.
Oh, okay.
You know, and then we put some like kind of like a banister or kind of like the side of a ship, kind of, you know, little thing like, you know, little kind of like side to it down one side. And we shot the whole thing in that little elbow of like the banisters and the deck of the ship. Mm-hmm. And we rocked it. We had four people with hoses and we had like a couple of little flashes going on and it totally sells. Being like a galleon in the ocean with the wind blowing and screaming and reaching hands.
I love that because I love how the DP, especially the cinematography, the role of a cinematographer, it's not just about beauty, but you're always problem solving in that way because you know and have kind of this knowledge of what the eye of the camera is going to see and how it's going to be perceived. So you're constantly, I feel like, as a DP, coming up with creative solutions to stuff just like this, like trying to make things look more real.
You have to be because, I mean, ultimately, you have these great directors who are like, oh, I have this vision. And then you've got the producers being like, well, we have this much money. And then you've got the production designer saying, well, we only have this much paint or whatever else it is. What it really kind of comes down to is like the DP is kind of where the rubber meets the road, where like dreams could become reality. And it's like, okay, this is what we can achieve. Like this is what we can do with your mind. And there's a million ways around that to try and kind of improve that and kind of do little kind of cool, funky tricks around it. And you learn that a lot from other features you've worked or features, short films, music videos. You know, you learn a lot of these little cool, fun tricks or these cool ideas or these cool concepts from other places. And I'm always like, oh, that looked really cool. I wonder if we did this, we could make it feel this way or blah, blah, blah. So you just kind of take those ideas and kind of chase them through.
That's cool.
And then, you know, at some point you have to not make the movie that's on the page and you have to kind of physically figure out what it is. And I always think you've got to try and, like, I'd much prefer that that the whole movie was at 75%. Then you had like five scenes at like 150% and then the rest of the movie at 20%. Like,
Because
it's always going to feel like the lag and the thing. Make it consistent, put people in that world and you would be amazed at what people will let go and let go of if they believe the world and the story and the characters that you're with.
Yeah, yeah. Just hearing say all that stuff, it's making me want to make a movie with you again.
it's well overdue, man.
Too, Travis.
I know. We need to do it. We need to do it, man.
Spilling all my water here.
It's no joke.
It is overdue.
It is overdue. Yeah.
We got to get something else. And not found footage. Like traditionally shot, cinematic, you know, let's plan our shots and coverage. Honestly, though, like we went from Gallows to Gallows 2, which was not found footage.
Yep.
And it's funny because you think a lot of people look at found footage and they think it's like the easiest thing ever, but it's so hard to like you said, sell that world and make it feel real all the way through
yeah.
and justify the camera, justify the lighting and lack thereof, the yeah. sound, everything. So having the ability to do like just traditional coverage and edit.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like,
it's like, so yeah. it's night and day difference, and it's so much smoother to be able to just get the coverage and make a traditional movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I always think that like you put story first and like story and character first. Like I always joke with all the actors that I work with. I'm like, I just want to pick up what you're putting down. Like that's my job. Like if I can then make it look cool on top of that, great. If I can, you know, do anything else to like fluff the edges, awesome. Yeah. But like ultimately I don't want to be the DP that you walk out of the movie and be like, oh my God, that shot, that long one, did you see when they did this and they went down onto the beach and then they came up and they did all yeah. this stuff. It's like, if people are coming out and the first thing they said is, oh my God, that one, like you need to tell the story first. And right. like,
well, people like us typically are the ones that yeah, are yeah, walking out of
the films, the film students will be like
one
that.
Or yeah. the performance, but we pick yeah. apart each different category and kind of critique it differently. I'll say, yeah. man, that Warner was great. Oh, I loved her performance. Oh man, he was fantastic in this yeah. section. And
but the general audience, you want them to be clinging to the story first yeah. and foremost, or characters, or yeah. one and the same kind of.
But also going back to kind of like what you're saying about kind of, you know, depending on your budget and all that stuff, like the first decision that I try to make as a cinematographer is like concentrating on story and concentrating on my decisions that I'm making are being based on the story, being based on the look, being based on stuff. After that, then I come back to, okay, what's the budget? What can I afford? How can I do this? But if you go through and do your first pass of the script, and I always say this with the shot list as well, I always sit down with the directors and they're, well, can we afford that? I was like, that's not your job. That's my job to figure out how we're going to do it. I can then take that to the producer and say, hey, like, I really want to do this and we need a crane for one day and I can save you money on these five other days so that we can afford it. But like, this is what we need to get this thing. And maybe the producer will be like, that's completely nonsense. We don't need all of that. But okay, so we can't do that. So what do I do? Okay, well, maybe we, you know, like what was the essence? What did we want to capture with that shot?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe we break it up and we do a high angle and we do a low angle and we go in between.
Right, you know? Right.
So if you start with the wish and the base from the beginning, you know, you can always kind of adapt and adjust from there. But if you start trying to adapt and adjust as you shot list and right from the very start, you're going to end up with like something subpar.
That's a really great point. So Ed, let's back up a little bit and I want to hear kind of how you got into doing what you do.
Yeah. Like, where did you start? Where were you like, hey, you know,
and when did you realize you wanted to be a DP specifically?
Yeah.
Because I think Noah, we were talking to Noah earlier, and he made a great point. A lot of people that get into movies, it's almost always like, oh, I want to write and direct and make my own films. Yeah. You know, like for you, what was that journey like?
For me, I mean, like I've always been a film lover. I've always loved watching movies, cinema, or, you know, whatever you want to put it, TV, everything else. I picked up photography in my final year of high school. Just to pick up some extra credits. In England, it's a little bit different the way that everything works.
Yeah, they don't have cheerleaders in England.
They do not have cheerleaders.
I remember you saying that when we first
creatures.
Met.
Still, every time I see cheerleaders, I'm like, they do exist. Like, it's so bizarre to me. It's so strange, yeah.
I love it.
So I picked up photography in my final year of high school. And I was always an art scholar. I'd done sculpture and drawing and painting and all of this stuff, you know, from a young age. But I left school suddenly with this kind of idea of wanting to do fashion photography.
Okay.
I went and kind of dabbled in that world for 6 months or so, realized it wasn't the industry that I wanted to be in. It was far too singular. It wasn't enough teamwork. It wasn't really planned enough. It was just like show up on the day and make things happen. And it was all based around like the rock star photographer. And that's like, I don't want that. I believe in team sports and team efforts.
Yeah,
and like everyone working together was a goal. So I ended up going and working on the set of Tomb Raider 2, sculpting 40-foot styrofoam trees.
Oh, really?
Nice. Yeah.
So that was my first job on the film in the film industry. And whilst I was there, somebody saw my photos and was like, oh, these are actually pretty good photos. Like, you should be a cinematographer. And like the famous line that my brother was teasing me about now is, I was like, cinematographer? I was like, what's that, like a cameraman? Like, yeah, kind of a cameraman. Yeah, somehow my brother always calls me a cameraman just to like throw in the elbow.
Your twin brother, right?
Twin brother.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So.
Yes, that's ladies, that's right. There's two of them.
There are two of them. There's two.
So, I'm just going to sit here and blush quietly. So that's kind of where it kind of really first started. And then I left there and was trying to figure out what to do next. Like, I hadn't had any exposure to the film industry. I didn't really know anybody in the film industry. So I was like, okay, well, I guess you've just got to go to school for this stuff. So I started to look at film schools. This is when I was 18, and in England you take a gap year, so it's a year out between like high school and college, and I think it's like one of the best ideas in the world because it changed my life completely.
Just to like get rid of the mentality of school or just experience something different, just to go out.
I mean, like, you know, some people go and work in their local bar, but I mean, a lot of people will go out and travel. Oh, dude, there's usually a lot of drinking no matter where you go. What was it, English? Don't forget that. Yeah. So we've been drinking since we're 16 already. So we're like, I mean, my high school had a bar in it.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm serious. Like, Americans always, their minds just explode when you say this. No, my high school had a bar in it because you're legally allowed to go and buy alcohol at 18 in England. So in the last year of high school, some people are legal, some people aren't. So the school had a bar in it so that if you weren't 18, you were still able to like stay on premises, be supervised.
They could monitor
and monitor it, which of course is ridiculous because your friends are the ones pouring the drinks and you all have a token. So you'd be like, oh, here's my token. And they'd be like, oh, here's your beer and your token back. So we'd just be sitting there So my high school had a bar. So,
Well, that'll help you get through finals. That's for sure.
Or commiserate finals.
I got finals this week.
Hold my beer.
I need a drink. Yeah, hold my beer.
Exactly. I'm going in. Take my drink. Yeah.
All right, let's ace this test.
So all my gap year, basically, I just searched film schools, and I looked at a couple in England, and I was too young and I didn't have the experience. And then I came across the New York Film Academy, and the New York Film Academy, they have a 6-week course over Christmas, and I liked it because it was 6 weeks, but because it was over Christmas, nobody wanted to, I guess the participation is lower. So it was the price of the 4-week course, but because of Christmas, they gave you 2 weeks off in the middle. So it was the length of the 8-week course. So nice. I was like, great, 8 weeks for the price of 4, bonus. The problem was that it was Thursday when I found it, and it started on Monday.
Oh, wow.
So I just went home, packed a bag, and left to New York. And my sister called me like 2 days after I got to New York, and she was like, hey, when you come back from London, can you bring some milk back or whatever? It was some meal.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not back for a few months. I'm in New York. She had no idea. So
I love that though. That's some of the cool stuff that we've talked about where you have to just make a move, do something bold.
Honestly, I mean, that was the thing. I was just like, just do it and go. So I was out there. I was meant to be there for 8 weeks. I stayed 8 months. My visa finally was like, couldn't be renewed again. And like, I just had to leave. So I left. I went back to England and kind of bullied my way into the London Film School, honestly. Mm. Graduated from the London Film School at 21 with my first master's in film, and then came out to AFI at 22, and got my second master's from AFI, specifically in cinematography. The first one was just a general filmmaking program. The second one was specifically cinematography. And then the plan was to really spend maybe a year or two in LA and then kind of go back to London probably and just see where the world took me. Mm-hmm. And work picked up here and it never slowed down. It just never made sense to leave. So 15 years later, I'm still at least based in Los Angeles, but out of the 30 odd features that I've done, only 2 of them have actually been shot in LA. The rest have all been either in Fresno or in Texas or in Buenos Aires or Amsterdam or Japan or like all these other places.
That's amazing, dude.
That's pretty cool. You get to travel all over the place. And I think that's awesome too, that you just like Travis was saying, when you have that kind of gut instinct or feeling of something you should do, and even if it's like a big move, like going to New York on a whim, you got to follow those promptings, you know, because 99% of the time, I feel like they're correct, you know, like you need to follow them through, even if they end up not going the way you're planning.
Yeah.
I feel like it's always a good idea to follow them, you know, and see where they go.
Well, no, and that's the thing is that ultimately, look, you're going to end up with a great story, if nothing else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, go out, live. And like, this is the big thing I'd say is just go and live. Like, people are so, especially, you know, and I was kind of like this when I first started as well. I was so honed on being like the youngest to do this, the first to do this, the youngest to be whatever. It's like, let go of that. Live your journey. Don't worry about your friends and seeing what they're doing. And, you know,
don't compare yourself to those others that you think are more successful, yeah, that you think are doing better. All the while, they're really just posting their best pictures on their best days, yeah, in their best vacation spots.
Yeah.
And you don't see 99% of the other time when they're miserable, depressed, washing dishes and taking out the garbage.
And that's filmmaking, honestly. That's filmmaking as well.
Yeah. It's a legitimate thing. I mean, there's a guy that I went to the London Film School with, and I won't say who he is or what the project is, but he's done a big TV show in England. It got picked up for another series. And he was like, oh God, I'm stuck on this like thing, blah, blah, blah. And it's not really what I usually do. And, but now I'm stuck. I'm like, dude, this is like a major series that is like getting buzz all over like both sides of the ocean. I was like, but looking at him, you'd be like, oh my God, he's on like cloud nine. And then you talk to him, he's like, oh, I'm miserable. I wish I was just doing indie features like you, man. And they're being like, God, I wish I did too.
Yeah. All right, let's swap.
Yeah, everyone swap doing places. Indie is like, I want to be there.
The
yeah.
grass is always greener because you meet guys that are doing commercials and they're like, oh, but I wish I could just get into some story stuff. And then like you meet guys that are doing story stuff and they're like, oh God, I just wish I could just make stuff look flashy and pretty for two
frames. Yeah, make some
But, there, you know, I think there's a little bit of, like for us, when we're between films, we're basically out of work, you know?
Yeah.
I
mean,
and so it's up to us to kind of continue creating and writing and coming up with things or getting together with other creators who have ideas to actually make something happen. But in those times, we often find ourselves saying, man, there's a lot of money in just marketing and commercial advertising and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You could make a movie for $100,000. Or you could make a commercial for a soda company for $5 million, $10 million.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's
sometimes you want to make the commercial.
Yeah. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with doing that. Honestly, bouncing around between different formats and different, you know, like commercials and documentaries, like, you know, some of the stuff that I've done has been documentary and I love it. You just show up and film what happens. You don't need to worry about planning and setting and doing all this stuff. You know, I've got friends, you know, or like I've done some reality work. Every time I do reality stuff, I like go away, you know, leave cringing. But but also that's then influenced me in the way that I then shoot handheld or the way that I'll, you know, do something. So you learn something from every job. So, you know, if you're stuck in the corporate world, do the corporate world to the best of your ability, but learn what you're doing from that and what you can do to then make that better and do the best of whatever's on the table in front of you, but always be striving to push forward and do something different. You know,
that's awesome. I want to talk to you, Ed, about some of your cinematography style and preferences. Yeah. Like what are some of your favorite kind of shots, techniques, things maybe that are specific to you that you like to employ?
I don't know. Honestly, I hope that it's not, I mean, like I'm sure I have a style. Like, I just like to do what I think is story based, you know what I mean? And what makes sense to the story and what's going to give me that feeling. I do find that I use like, you know, lens babies and weird kind of funky cool lenses that give weird effects and stuff like that. I like that. I like to kind of use a decent amount of color and then quite often desaturate that later so that you still have those tones in there. Did that a lot in The Party's Just Beginning, which was we did a lot of sodium vapor and a lot of like, you know, kind of pretty colorful lighting and then sucked all of that out later because it brings everything down and then you end up with these kind of cool kind of muted colors and all of that stuff.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on the story, honestly, because on the, you know, again, to go to The Party's Just Beginning, when we first started out with that movie, so, you know, if you've seen it or not, it basically runs with two parallel story, you know, timelines. It's her best friend a year ago leading up to his suicide, and then a year later leading up to his kind of like the anniversary of his suicide. Mm-hmm. And we were like playing with the idea of like, oh, well, you know, like a year ago when everything was happy before, the, you know, before he committed suicide, this is the, you know, we wanted it to be golden and warm and stuff. And then like all the new stuff would then be desaturated and plain. And it just didn't really feel right. So we started to play with, okay, well, what if we did different lenses for different feelings? We're like, okay, yeah, it's getting there, but not quite. what we ended up actually doing was actually attaching the lenses, but also the aspect ratio to basically happiness in the okay. movie. So if you look at the first storyline a year ago, it obviously starts off happy, but as it gets closer to the suicide, it gets kind of sadder. So you start off, you know, on these, you know, one set of lenses and like 2-3-5, because it's a little bit more cinematic. It's a little bit more like you're in a bit of a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And then it goes basically towards 1.85. Then her story in the present day starts off 1.85 because she's kind of miserable and it's a little bit more grounded and a little bit more kind of documentary raw kind of feeling, yeah. you know? And she meets this guy and it moves towards happiness. So it starts to shut down to 2-3-5 and starts to get warmer in colors and tones and feelings. And then at the end, as she starts to, you know, kind of panic and starts to have her own sort of crisis, it goes dark again. Mm. So then you move back towards 1.85 and colors. So, you know, you kind of start to, build these rules for yourself.
That's interesting. I always think
that's the best thing, is to kind of set rules and then observe them and then know when to break them, because it'll give you a completely different feeling.
Right.
That's super cool, because that's stuff that those are the kinds of things that directors of photography or cinematographers know about yeah. that they can employ in a film, that people watching the film will have no idea how to explain it. They'll have no idea that it's happening.
Yeah.
But they can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
They can't explain it, but they get the feeling, they connect to what it was intended for.
Yeah.
Without being able to explain it. And I think that's really great.
Well, no, 100%. And that's the things that, you know, the example that I always give my directors when I first start working with them is that if you shoot somebody flat against a wall, it's called flat space. So the wall's, parallel to the camera, or sorry, perpendicular to the camera. And you shoot the whole movie like that, it's going to feel very kind of Wes Anderson, like very just kind of staged, yeah. very kind of like, yeah. but also very kind of blocked off.
Very two-dimensional book.
Yeah. If that character suddenly, at the end of the movie, suddenly finds out that she's pregnant and she didn't think that she could ever get pregnant, and suddenly you shoot that shot in a corridor and the corridor just disappears down there behind her, the audience isn't going to be like, oh, that's deep space versus flat space. No, but they'll be able to feel a change and they'll feel yeah. a difference and just kind of know what it is. So,
yeah.
you know, not know what it is, but just feel that release of that tension. And that's what I mean, is that you make these rules like, oh, we always shoot this person against flat, flat against a wall. And then you break it. And when you break it, that's what like then catapults like a feeling.
Right.
You
know? And those are just little tricks too, going back to, you don't need all the fancy tools and think yeah. to do what you just said. You know, like yeah. playing with visual cool. shapes, lines, composition, all of those things, aspect ratio. It's like, it doesn't cost you anything to do that. It's just like, experiment, find those tricks, see how they affect yeah. your film and your story.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, playing with the power side of the film, generally, what, you know, if you have two characters, you know, sitting on a bench looking at each other, the one on the left is generally going to feel more powerful than the one on the right. And if you start to watch movies and you start to see movies that have affected you and you start to look back on that, you start to realize that. So, but it's like, when do you give somebody the power in the scene? Do you change the line and come over when, you know, when he makes a threat and then come back? You know, like, how do you start to kind of play these images? But none of that's equipment based. That's all story based.
Right.
And that's yeah. like how you move the camera, how you use the lenses, how you do that. I mean, like, I love working with production design where you start to kind of limit colors and you take out reds, you know, you like, so everything's blues and greens and whatever's, you know, and taking away things sometimes can be just as, you know, effective as adding them or trying to make it bigger.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's amazing. Any favorite films of yours based on cinematography? Like some of the
of
ones.
Of mine personally?
Yeah, of your personal.
Well, of the ones that he's done or the ones.
It takes me like 3 to 5 years to watch anything.
What about other films? Like who do you aspire to?
Who do you look to for inspiration in
some films that you watch and you're just like, oh, I love the way that looks.
I mean, Deakins is always like an easy go-to. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you can
he's
pretty
great.
Much guarantee that whatever he's shot is like, holy shit. Like, okay, yeah. cool. It kind of fits. But I mean, like, same thing. If you watch his stuff, a lot of it, I mean, with the exception of maybe Blade Runner and a couple of others, but the vast majority of his work is incredibly story-based and character-based.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So like No Country for Old Men, there's that cool shot where he's sitting on the bed with a shotgun waiting for Javier Bardem to come into the hotel room, and like you see the shadows under the door and all of that stuff. it's incredibly stylized, but also it's totally plausible. Like, he's sitting there with a lamp behind him. He's in complete silhouette. You don't question that he's in silhouette. It doesn't look like a gimmicky thing. It's like, it's all just completely grounded in reality.
Yeah.
So that's what I really like. I like kind of work that kind of pushes a stylist, kind of like a cool idea or a cool concept, but it's all totally grounded and kind of like, you know, kind of explained. I'm not a big one for lighting weird and wonderful, you know, sequences with no windows or big shafts of light and there's nothing there. Like, it just doesn't feel real to me. Like, I like something to be motivated and kind of grounded.
Right. No, that's cool. Yeah, we love Deacon
stuff.
What's
the most recent movie that you came out of and said, that cinematography was awesome. I wish that I could have been on that movie.
Well, you know, I actually just watched a TV series. It's called End of the Effing Expert, like Astro's World.
On
Netflix. That, I think that was beautifully shot. Like, it's very deliberate in the way that it's covered. It's very deliberate in the way that it's shot, the colors, the saturation in it. It's really, really, really pretty. But it's, again, it's all based on story and the visuals support the characters, support the feeling, support the motives and help push that forward. So I think that was kind of one of my favorites recently.
We were talking on one of our last episodes about Whiplash.
Yeah.
It had come up about, I think we were talking about pitching our films and, you know, making proof of concept shorts, which we've done a lot of. And Whiplash started as a proof of concept short that you shot, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. Tell us about, you know, kind of how you got in on that and working with Damien Chazelle and JK and all those.
Yeah, people. No, that was a trip in itself because, again, same thing. I mean, that was another one of these stories where Gabby, actually, who was a producer on this, she actually brought me in on that and was like, hey, I know you're not, you know, you're kind of doing more features and you're not really doing shorts. And at that point, I really was trying not to do so many short films and everything else. But she was like, I kind of like this guy and this kind of, and I read the script and honestly, I was like, I don't know. It's a lot of talking and a lot of like, and it's like music stuff. I'm not really musical.
Jazz, you know, at that. So some people don't even consider jazz to be real music.
I hope Damien,
which is one of the reasons Damien wanted to make the movie. Like, it is music. It's the best music. I get to see him.
No, so, you know, the thing is with that, which was kind of interesting, was I went and met him just because, you know, even if I read a script and I'm like not 100% sure of if I'm either available or if or whatever, I always want to meet a new director and I always meet people just because it's cool that you know meeting people that are doing and not just talking. So I go over and I meet him and I'm like, this is cool, like we just clicked, we got along really well, we had a lot of cool ideas. Like, he talked a lot about how he wanted to film and these kind of ideas that of like cutting on rhythm and doing all this stuff. And that gave me a lot of ideas. And suddenly this script of people talking in a room suddenly started to kind of grow in my head. I was like, oh, you know what? I want to do this, like 100%. So we did it. I think we shot something like 26 pages in 3 days, I think it was. Wow. The short film originally was much longer. And then there was a female character or kind of like a you know, somebody that was kind of interested in our main character or vice versa, which ended up being cut out of the short film and actually also wasn't in the feature either. And there's a bunch of other stuff which we shot and completely got sidetracked or got you know, put on the cutting room floor. But yeah, I mean, it was a great experience. I mean, it sucked I didn't get to do the feature ultimately, because when it came down to funding the movie and all of this stuff, what I was told is that because I hadn't done a studio movie, I, you know, they were looking for somebody to back up Damien as a first time feature director. So yeah, they wanted studio experienced crew.
It's kind of lame, man. I mean, that's happened to us a couple times, like for directing jobs. Like, we had this directing job we were potentially up for, and it was the same thing. They wanted studio experience.
Yeah, in fact, we shot something for, you're talking about Are You Afraid of the Dark at Paramount Players? So Paramount had this thing. Our manager was like, hey, you guys could actually shoot something. So they want to meet with you in like 2 weeks. We're like, yeah, we'll shoot something along the lines of the script to really showcase. Yeah. And then he's, you know, we're planning it. And he's like, hey, they moved the meeting up to Tuesday. And we're like, wait, that's 3 days.
Yeah.
So we shot something anyway. And it turned out great. And we showed it to them. And I think they loved the pitch. It was, I think he relayed to us that it was the strongest pitch. But there was a guy who was up for it that had done like Disturbia,
studio movies,
big name stuff,
and
stuff.
Like big movies, Eagle Eye, like, and the guy's a solid guy. I like both of those movies a lot. So
yeah,
that's still pretty cool though, man. I mean, what a cool piece of film history to be a part of though. I mean, Whiplash is I don't know, it's very memorable. It's a very memorable movie.
Oh, massively. And if you go online and you look at, like, you know, Whiplash versus Whiplash Short, somebody actually put the two up, you know, top and bottom and plays them side by side. And like Damien said this to me actually after the feature came out. I went and grabbed lunch with him and we're just kind of catching up. And he was like, "Look, have you seen it yet?" I was like, no, I haven't seen it yet. I was like, you know, it's a little close. And at this point, it was already getting Oscar buzz because, yeah, you're going to want to kill me. And I'm like, dude, I already want to kill you. It's getting Oscar buzz. It's been out for 2 months. Yeah. And this is like January and they're already talking about it winning Oscars. You know what I mean? I'm like, God. I was like, yeah, of course I want to kill you. But I was like, why? What else? What do I need to know? You know, going, he goes, well, I like the short film so much. We did, you know, we copied a lot of it shot for shot. And when you go and watch Whiplash versus Whiplash Short, it's like cut for cut.
Oh, yeah,
even
I remember
stuff that we had like ad-libbed with the Steadicam where we're like, oh, we want this shot here.
Yeah.
And then we'll find something in the middle, but then we want to finish here. And then all of this finding stuff in the middle, they ended up almost copying that in the feature and all that stuff. So yeah.
We're giving you credit, Ed. We're giving you credit for that Oscar.
No, I mean,
you know, hey,
credit
they did get snubbed, I think. I think they should have got Best Picture that year.
I do too.
It was a great movie. I mean, like,
Argo that took it.
Damien killed it. He did an amazing job. I'm still friends with the guy. You know, obviously he's gone on to like a different stratosphere. And that movie would have put me into a different kind of world as well. But kind of what I was going back to saying is that you can't live other people's stories. You've just got to do your life and go through. And honestly, it's just a fun chapter in a book. Like, you know, I get asked it with every Q&A or everything that I do, or like every interview even. Everyone's like, so Whiplash. I'm like,
yeah, I still think it's pretty awesome just for all the reasons we just talked about.
Totally, it's cool to be a part of,
it's
honestly.
It's a great experience.
Yeah.
I want to know who you, you've worked with some cool people. I guess The Party's Just Beginning is one of my kids' favorite people because of Jumanji and Guardians and all that stuff. But what was it like working with Karen Gillan?
Karen Gillan's a sweetheart. She's amazing. Yeah, she's super fun. She was another one who just came with a ton of ideas, and she's not afraid to kind of like experiment and try.
As an actress, it seems like she doesn't hold back and she really likes to go for it on stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And she's got this crazy sense of humor. She's, you know, I mean, The Party's Just Beginning is a pretty dark movie, but it's almost a kind of a comedy as well. Like, it's got some real Scottish humor there where it's like, wow. Yeah. But no, she was amazing to work with. She was great. We're talking about other stuff, hopefully in the future. So that'd be awesome to work with her again and everything. Cool. So
that's amazing.
But yeah, I mean, it's just different. I mean, everybody has different methods of working and you kind of just have to try and feel out who works in which ways and try and compliment them, you know?
Yeah.
Especially as a cinematographer, you're really there to kind of support your directors and kind of help them with their vision. You know, like I always joke at the beginning, I'm like, look, all of my good ideas are yours and all of your bad ideas are mine. Like, and I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, between that and then also I have a rule that I generally, you know, will say something 3 times. So if I see an issue with something, I'll say something for sure, always.
Yeah.
If it's a little bit bigger of a deal than I think that they're realizing, or there's an issue or something, or I'm like, dude, this is really going to be an issue later, I'll raise it a second time. If I have to say something, I'll say something a third time. If I'm like, no, dude, that means we've got to shoot double coverage. It means it's going to take 3 hours longer to shoot this scene. It's going to be an absolute nightmare. It's going to be this, this, and this. Or, dude, I don't know how you're going to cut this to this. And blah, blah,
don't
blah.
Do it. Oh, no, like, don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't do it. You know, but then after that, after the third time, if they're like, no, I really want to do this, I'm like, cool. It's your movie.
Yeah.
Like 100%, that's your name up there. And it's happened where sometimes I've been right and sometimes they've been right. You know what I mean? So you never know, like, you know, the way it's going to be cut later. They've got an idea in their head. Maybe they haven't quite explained it, or maybe they just have a feeling of what they want. And you know, that's it. Like, it's ultimately I'm there to support you guys as directors or whoever the director is. And that's all you can do. Like, you've just got to kind of, and then take a step back and be like, okay, cool. Like, onwards. Like, how do we make this as good as we can?
Nice.
We were talking just right before we started rolling about working with Michael Shannon as well. And that was a pretty cool experience as well. You were saying he's pretty intense on set.
Michael's great. I've had the pleasure of doing two movies with him. One where he was playing kind of like a, like a rowing coach. And he's like an ex-Vietnam vet and like all this kind of stuff. And then another movie where he's playing like a very kind of troubled writer who's trying to find himself or whatever it is. It was interesting working with him because like a lot of people are like, Mike Shannon, I don't know him. And then they look him up and they're like, oh yeah, I know that.
I've seen him in everything.
I've seen him in stuff. And but like literally like when you start to watch stuff like or even talking to him, you suddenly realize how much stuff he's been in from Groundhog Day to all this other
Remember
stuff.
Remember we were watching it and I was like, that's Michael Shannon. Why don't we go to the WWE? Yeah. No way, wrestling tickets.
And it's just amazing. Like you see him in all the stuff like that and Mud and like all these other movies.
Great in Mud.
Where he's just he just takes on that character and you just don't really realize it's him.
Having worked with all these big actors, because you've worked with quite a few, Bruce Willis. I mean, you've worked with some big names. And feel free to drop names here if you don't want to. If you don't want to, that's fine. But I'm curious because I know some actors are very specific on ways they are shot. Yeah. And they'll have like, oh, don't shoot me from this side. Don't shoot me at this angle.
They know their best angle.
Yeah. Which is cool. I think that's cool. But like, have you run into any of that? Like with any of these actors?
There was a couple of tense moments. And I think I can say this because the story ends well. So when I worked with Rita Wilson, and a lot of the time it's female actors that know what's worked in the past.
Right, they're held to such a standard within the industry that they have to be on guard for that kind of stuff.
There's a real reason.
You know, because the people that they're trying to do things with or get jobs from will be so judgmental. Exactly. It is the most judgmental thing. Don't act like you're not a judgmental person, Mr. Producer, casting director, whoever you are, audience. Don't think for a second you're not a judgmental person because you are. And that puts them through a lot of stress, these actors and actresses especially.
There's always this conversation, which I have to have with every director, you know, about any movie. And even when I worked with Karen, when she's directing herself as the lead, and for that, I'll come back to that story in a second. But with like Rita Wilson, what happened is the first day on set we're shooting, and it's like the worst scene to have to open with a female actress, you know, is that we're outside blaring sun. It was kind of the wrong time of day, but it had to be that time of day for our schedule. The sun was high. It was just very toppy. It's just not going to be a good look ever. We'd done a lot to kind of like equal stuff out and da da da. But she could see herself in the reflection of the ND glass in the camera. That accentuates and makes it look even worse. So she was like, no, this isn't working. And she literally walked off set, like first day that I ever worked with her. I was like, oh god.
No.
I was like,
you realize what you've done?
And like, I was like, what have I done? But she didn't walk off set in a bad way. She was just like, no, this needs to be fixed. 110% right. You know, nothing wrong with what she was saying. So I was like, look, okay, we figured it out. Da, 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 da. We brought it back. We figured, you know, thing and stuff. And then I spent the next like couple of days figuring out what was going to be work, you know, like what worked with her and what, you know, and kind of, you know, not saying how do you want to be lit? Because ultimately that's also the thing is that sometimes, I'm not saying in this case, but some actors, they want to look like they're pinup models the whole time. And you're like, dude, you're playing like a soccer mom that with a drug addiction. I mean? Like you shouldn't look like a pinup model. You don't want to do full glam lighting the whole time, but you've got to find something that they're comfortable with and something else. Yep. Da, 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 da. By the end of that movie, though, we had kind of figured out a routine, something that she, you know, that kind of helped her as well and kind of felt good to her, but still gave me the rough edges that I wanted to and all that stuff. And by the end of the movie, we were like great friends and she was bringing me fruit from her garden and all that stuff. So, I mean, it ended really well.
Yeah.
When I worked with Karen and actually had this conversation with the producer and Karen, because usually I just ask the director and then I'll just have to hold them honest and okay, fine. But when your actress is your director and you're saying, okay, so this is some really rough storylines here. How much beauty stuff do you, like, are we going to give you? Like, how pretty do you want to look? Are we going to take all the blotchiness out your skin when you're crying? Are we going to, you know, is it just like, how raw are we going? Karen was like, no, full raw. I want to go. I'm not going to be wearing any makeup. Yeah. And it's this, yeah. And it's this, da, 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 da.
I want real. Yeah. I want real. Yeah.
Everybody wants real until they see real.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And then they're like, that's a little too real.
Yeah.
Yeah. When keeping it real goes wrong.
But, you know, but I mean, it's just, you know, and it's a natural thing where you're going to want to at some point, like, be like, oh God, I'm out on a limb here. I need to pull it back. You know what I mean? And a few days into filming, Cam was like, so I've been thinking about it and maybe we did it. And the producer was like, no, you said, and he said you were going to say this and, you know, and we kind of went through stuff and it was all like good faith. And honestly, if she really needed us to take more care of her visually, we could have and we would have, obviously. But I believe for the story, it wasn't the right thing. We had a good conversation about it. She was, and she just needed that little bit of reassurance. It was all going to be okay. And I think the movie came out looking great because of that. And there's some great stuff with her, which is really raw and really open. And it's incredible.
We were talking about that, actually. How, like, it's really cool to find actors that can, like, when they're dolled up, they look amazing. But they can also look really weathered and haggard, like they've been through some serious stuff.
They've lived. Yeah.
And she's able to pull that off. Some other good ones are like, Helen Hunt, Toni Collette also.
I think it's a positive for actors personally, I think, because you don't want, I feel like you don't want the perfect model like in your movie as like, I don't know, because you can, it just takes you out of the movie.
But
you know?
It's
like,
tough though, because you can say that and then you can say, oh, but look at, you know, female X in this movie and they're like, oh my God, she was amazing in that. And then you've got the Brigitte on the side of the table, but is she this character? Because now she looks like she's, you know, 95 or whatever, you know.
It's a weird thing.
It's such a,
especially
such a
these days.
Word. Yeah.
Because the movies I grew up on, I mean, I'm thinking of one in particular with Michael Keaton, The Dream Team. I don't know if you've ever seen The Dream Team.
I don't know if I have.
It's a great movie. Michael Keaton's in it, and it's basically him and his patient buddies are trying to go to mental patient. They're from a mental hospital.
Okay.
And their doctor is trying to get them to go to a baseball game together, like a big baseball game in the city. Well, something terrible happens to their doctor, and then they're all like loose mental patients in the big city, you know? But they're all just regular looking guys. I mean, Michael Keaton's haircut is just like regular, little bit of a mullet, you know, his teeth weren't as perfect as they are now. And the standard for actors has really grown. And it's like, you have to have flawless skin. You have to have the best eyelashes. You have to have the perfect teeth. You have to, and it's like, it's this kind of faux world. We get into kind of the, well, what's real, you know, what are the expectations for young women and young men even that just see these supermodel looking guys and girls. And is that all we have, you know? But then you have some people that are genuine. They can look amazing when they're made up, but they also feel so real. And they speak to you, I think, in ways that you wouldn't get if you were having to look through a Rose Huntington or someone, you know?
I mean,
it's like, it's hard to see past the facade or past just the face value when the face value is quite extraordinary in some of these cases.
Yeah.
And the beauty and it is extraordinary. That's why they exploit it. That's why they pump it out in all these movies. But there's something I feel to that grounded, you know, every person kind of a
relatable kind
of a vibe.
Yeah. I agree.
The Bradley Coopers, I guess.
Go have a beer world. With her in high school with Bradley Cooper.
Yeah. In London. Get your beer in London high schools. Yes. But
that's interesting
stuff. The standard's different. It's different. So they always have to be aware.
And it's tricky
of that.
because it's not necessarily just the job that you're working on. You know what I mean? It's their next job and it's their next job after that. And it's the next, you know, it's this one of those things where there was such a big fuss a few years ago where, where a certain website was putting up actors, birth dates.
Mm.
And I've got friends that are in their 30s and they play like young 20s and they're like, I cannot have my birth date on there because they will just not even like
they won't
look
even
at my audition.
Yeah.
But yet they routinely play 10 years younger or more. You know what I mean? It's crazy. They're smaller or whatever thing and they fit. And so like it's just that judgment. It's those preconceived notions, and the world would be an amazing place if nobody ever had them. But you'd be lying to yourself if people didn't have those.
Right.
It reminds me of the movie Hitch, which I love. Hitch is a great one where he's basically saying Albert Brenneman is a good guy.
Yeah.
And he needed someone like me to help you women get out of your own way to give him a chance. So a lot of these actors are like, I can't tell people my age. I can't let them see the worst of me because they will get in their own mind about it and they won't hire me because they won't see what I can do. And they're only looking at the things that they think that I can't do.
Kind of the surface level stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. So it is a dance for actors to try to stay relevant and stay hot and stay, you know, on fire with gigs. So I totally get that. I totally get that.
But I think, you know, and like bringing it back to cinematography, like I've also had friends that, that don't want to do found footage movies because they can't be made, you know, because you don't want to make a found footage movie look sexy and appealing or great or whatever. So I've got friends that like do commercial work, which I've spoken to, and they're like, yeah, I wouldn't do a found footage movie because same thing, like people are going to judge me on that and think that I'm not a good cinematographer. And I'm well, it's what the story is. So yeah, it's going to look like a high schooler shot it.
Yeah, you know?
So, I mean, it's just it's a weird thing, but yeah, people are always looking for exactly what they want. So, you know, I hear this more and more in the commercial world now. People are like, oh no, we want like, you know, a commercial, like our commercial has clowns and dogs in it. So we need to see that somebody has shot clowns and dogs, you know?
Yeah, you're trying to find the proof. It's a little too literal.
They have to see it.
Going back to your studio thing. It's like, oh, they have to have shot a studio movie. Yeah. You know, it's all these.
Exactly. Well, and that's, I think that's a bad thing. I think that's a terrible thing. That goes back to even actresses. Like, well, Scarlett Johansson was offered a role as like, was it a transgender person in a film? And everyone was like, she's not transgender. She shouldn't be able to act different than who she is. You know, it's like, wait a second, isn't that acting? Like that doesn't make sense. Like, plus, it's like, if you're trying to raise awareness to your cause, why not get one of the biggest actresses on the planet to play that role? You know?
Yeah.
So
it's,
like,
it's like one of those things. I mean, but it's also such a fine line between that and being kind of like unaware or unconscious of something where you have people, you know, playing roles that also make, you know, no sense. You know, you look at these big stars that go
like ScarJo in Ghost in the Shell.
That Ridley Scott one of Gods of Egypt or whatever, and it was like all white actors playing Egyptians.
Or it's the
like,
Prince of Persia with Gyllenhaal. Even though some of those are fun movies. You know?
Like, no, and that's the thing is that, you know, at some point you have to kind of like suspend, you know, your disbeliefs and all that stuff. But also there's, you know, like there's two sides to every coin is what I'm trying to say.
It depends on the movie too, you know.
You have to get out of your own way as an audience member or something.
Ed, what's next for you? What's lined up?
I'm talking to a few different projects. There's an Indian action movie actually, which just kind of popped up.
That is going to be awesome.
Super fun. So that'd be kind of interesting.
I hope you get it.
But I mean, me too. I mean, I don't know. We'll see.
Indian action movies are
Bollywood.
The best.
It's going to be a really interesting one. I was contacted first just to shoot the action unit and then ended up interviewing with the director. And I was like, wait, why am I meeting the director if I'm just shooting second unit action stuff? And then they were like, oh no, we'd think of you for the whole. So I don't know. So we'll see. That's still massively early days. Honestly, I usually don't know what's next until about 2 weeks, 3 weeks before. And then I get that call of being like, okay, now we're ready. Like there's like a dozen movies right now that I've talked to and that I'm interested that are all circling. They're all waiting on cast or they're all waiting on something else. There's a horror movie coming up, which has got a really fun storyline. I probably can't tell you too much about, unfortunately. So, I mean, there's always stuff that's kind of floating around and, you know, you never believe it until you're literally like walking in on the first day because.
Do you think of yourself as very picky when it comes to these things?
I'd like to say that I have high standards, but honestly, I love to work. I love to work. I love to tell stories and I love to work with new people.
Yeah, people's a big thing.
Hey, about old people?
I know old people say.
All right, good.
No, I mean, like, honestly, I'm a firm believer as well that some of your best opportunity or some of my best opportunities, I should say, have come out of in situations and circumstances of taking projects that by all means I didn't need to take or perhaps I shouldn't have taken. I did a short film and I met a, you know, met a producer on that that then hired me on my next 10 features.
Yeah.
But literally I did that short film for like for free and with nothing. And it was just kind of something where I just liked the director and it seemed like a why not kind of type thing.
It's a point we make with filmmakers and people all the time is don't be afraid to say yes to something that might seem like beneath you or low paying or anything like that. It's like
nothing's beneath you.
I know.
Like, get over yourself if you think something's beneath you. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, know when to say no if you aren't going to be able to do what you want to do with the project. But I'm a firm believer that it's better, especially when you're starting out, I think it's better to be on a set, meeting people that are doing stuff and not just talking about it, that are like-minded. And you'll be amazed at how many people you meet on those sets that all then about. Call you back on something. If you work that hard for free or for whatever else, like, you know, at least they're feeding you.
It's all about the connections. You know,
you're getting a free lunch and you're getting some cool footage from your showreel. Like, I've done movies where, like, I've, you know, come back out of it and something, oh God, how was that movie? And how'd it go? How was this? I was like, I don't know about the movie, but I've got about a minute and a half of really good looking stuff for my showreel. And that's the thing is that, you know, like as a DP, like I can't be held responsible for the movie. I can't be held responsible for the story. You know what I mean? That's not my job to go in and fix scenes. Like, yes, I'll talk to the director about it. We always end up talking about all these options and everything else. I think it's, you know, really important to understand your story. So you need to be asking these questions to your directors. But ultimately, that's their vision. And I'm not going to be judged as a cinematographer on their vision.
You know what and I mean? Everything can be changed in the edit too. I mean, it can be changed over and over and over again. And when it's released too, I mean, the way it is perceived and received and marketed and all, like there's so many stages to making a feature, especially that what you signed up for is definitely not exactly what's going to be the end product. I mean,
there's the old adage, you know, where you write and do pre-production on one movie and then you shoot a different movie and then you edit a completely different movie. And I mean, going back to the parties just beginning, we keep coming back to this a lot today, but I mean, in that movie, I mean, Karen was like, I really want to do something that's different. So I was like, well, we can change aspect ratios. It's not a common thing. Like some people hate it. Some people. So I think in that movie, we change aspect ratio maybe 30 times in the movie. We go in and out, backwards and forwards and stuff.
Hey, Nolan does it all the time too.
It happens. But I've never been at a screening where somebody's even noticed or mentioned it.
Right.
And then also there was a moment where Karen kind of, you know, like in the edit and all of that stuff, like she's seen it one way for a long time. And then she starts to say, and there starts to be these moments of doubt of like, oh, well, people don't really do this. Like this isn't true. Maybe we shouldn't. So we actually did a part of the movie where it was all 2-3-5. We couldn't really go all 1-8-5 without cutting off the edges and making it really cramped.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, we went 2-3-5 and we did a play. And there was a moment literally almost leading right up to color correction where that decision hadn't been made. And I kind of made my point for it and said, look, this is what we did. We did it for a reason. Like, stick to your beliefs, stick to your vision, da, da, da. Left it at that. And then I kind of waited and just went until I walked into the color bay to see which version, if we were doing the 2-3-5 or the mixed aspect ratios. Yeah. And Karen, to all of her credit, you know, turned around and thought about it and was like, no, this is what we started off as. This is what we're going to focus on. Let's keep it. And she kept it. And I think it's one of those things which I really love about the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't notice it. You will now have mentioned it, but like you don't necessarily notice it, but it has, like, it does give a different feeling to those scenes.
We did that on our most recent film, Held.
Yeah, we had one of those.
It was specific just one time. Moment in time, though, where it's maybe a little bit of a spoiler, but it's fun. Held, by the way, just recently came out on Blu-ray and DVD.
Shameless
and
plug.
Redbox. Redbox, and it's on demand and all those other places that you get your movies. But she goes from one room into another and the new room is like vintage.
Yeah.
So we switch going through this kind of dark closet door into a hidden room. And when she comes into it, it's like, you know, it's like Oz, you know, things changed, you know, but she walks through and all of a sudden it's standard.
It looks a little bit more standard def rather than like this kind of the cinematic world that she's been in or whatever. But
so to kind of take you visually back into the past as well. So it was kind of fun to be able to do that.
But I mean, that's the thing. There's so many ways to put feelings on movies. You know what I mean? It's like camera movement. There's a big difference between using a geared head or using a fluid head. They have totally different feels. One's always a little floaty. One's locked, completely locked, you know, yeah. And then you've got handheld, or you've got, I always call it kind of human support, where it's just like the camera sitting on your shoulder. You're not doing a handheld. It's not Saving Private Ryan,
yeah.
But it just has that little bit of a breathe, or that little bit of an uncertainty or whatever. Like, so you've got camera movement, you've got lenses, obviously there's a million lenses, everything else. You've got color separation, you know, like, you've got all these different ways, or like movement, you know, there's a difference, you know, between a Movi and a Steadicam and a crane and a dolly and, you know, a yeah. doorway dolly. Like, yeah. they all have their own uses. So you've just got to find what works and go with that.
Go ahead.
I had a question. Two questions, actually. One is there any genre of movie you feel like you've done too much of, or you are like, okay, I'm a little tired of? And what is the type of movie that you haven't got to do yet that you're like, man, I want to do this kind of a movie. I haven't got to do it yet. I want to do one like this. So,
okay. So one that do I feel like I've done too much of? I've done a lot of horror, okay. which is honestly, I love the genre. I'm a horror fan. I watch everything. I really enjoy it. So have I done too much of that? Probably not. There was a time when I was like, okay, I need to do something else but horror. But this next vampire movie is a horror movie. So yeah, you know, I'm not afraid to go back to that world, and I miss it. I love it. And then what do I want to do? I would love to do like a Road to Perdition, you know, like gangster, okay. Tommy Guns, you know, kind of Prohibition style era period movie. I did a World War II movie a couple of years ago. It just came out actually 6 months ago or whatever. And they renamed it Recon. Okay. It's a World War II movie. We shot it on Anamorphic up in like the snow up in Canada and all that stuff. And that was really fun to go and shoot like a period movie. I'd love to do like period stuff's really fun because you get to really kind of recreate the world. But that was another one of those movies where we were shooting in the dead of winter in Canada. The first 3 days we did all of our daytime exteriors, and then the movie was meant to be at night from like page 17 through to page 100 whatever.
Wow.
Like at night up in the mountains, yeah, in like, the snow. It was going to be
the worst
crazy.
Possible conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Comfort. Really? Yeah. Comfort was going to go out the window. So on day three, we had this long turnaround and stuff. And we went and grabbed dinner, and it was myself and the producer and a couple of other like the head production guys. And they're like, so guys, you know, we've been thinking, we've got a bit of an announcement. And I'm sitting at the other end of the table being like, okay, what's coming? There's a, well, we love how the movie looks. It looks so good with this anamorphic and the snow and all that stuff. We've decided we're going to make the whole movie day. And I'm just like sitting there, I'm like quiet at the end, just kind of like looking at my bread and just kind of like, what are they? And everyone's like, oh, that sounds great. We don't need to do nights. It's going to be more comfortable. It's going to be more this. It's going to be more that. Da, da, da. Bear in mind, we're shooting in Canada where like, you know, literally like dead of winter. And I think we had like maybe 8 hours of usable daytime daylight anyway. So suddenly I'm like doing the math. I'm like, oh my God. And the producer turns to me and says, Ed, you're kind of pretty quiet down there at the other end of the table. I was like, I'll be fine. I just need a minute. Because the other thing as well is that we had scouted all these locations, you know, and I'd, you know, picked these stuff. And like a lot of these trees, a lot of these locations are just woodland. So the director's like, dude, tree is a tree. Like, what do you think? Like, where do you want to be or whatever, right. blah, blah.
Yeah.
So we'd picked a lot of these locations being like, oh, I'm only ever going to light this first two rows of trees and it's going to feel like we're in deep woods. But then there's a massive vista that when it's pitch black, you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly daytime, that location doesn't work anymore because they're meant to be on the valley floor at this point in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So we re-scouted the whole movie over that next weekend and reshuffled all of our locations, did all that stuff.
And that's when a brilliant idea from an executive or a producer totally derails your creative mojo.
It does, but I mean, ultimately, you have to kind of pivot, and like, there's a reason they did it. There's a reason how you kind of figure it out, and like, you pivot and embrace it. And now I look at that movie, and I'm super happy with how that movie turned out, how it looks. And there's stuff that you wouldn't have seen at night. There was stuff that you know that stands out, and there's other stuff that we had to navigate around and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, that was another thing where it's like, okay, well, how do you light all this stuff at nighttime? And I had this whole big extravagant kind of idea of how I wanted to light it. So we had ordered these big, I think they were like 10 feet wide weather balloons, white weather balloons. Mm. We're going to fill them full of helium, put them in basically in cargo nets, yeah, and like hide them up in the trees,
yeah,
and then bounce lights off of them.
Those
to, like,
are great. Kind of did you stuff. Were you able to use them?
I've used them before
because they work great when they work. They work great.
Well, no, so they do the helium balloons, which have the lights inside.
Okay,
I'm not a big fan of those because they end up casting a lot of light behind the light.
Okay,
if you bounce lights into just regular weather balloons, you've actually got a little bit more control over where you get the light bouncing through and coming back from. And also, we couldn't afford those big, you know, like. Helium balloons are like the techs cost more than the dinner, you know, do most of it. So, I mean, yeah, so you end up kind of trying to so for our budget, it didn't work. So we had to come up with other ways just regular weather balloons was what we were going to work with and stuff. So yeah, it would have looked great,
interesting.
But ultimately I was super happy with how the movie came out. So, you know, it's just a weird thing, you know, sometimes it's easier than others.
Well, are there any horror stories that you have? I mean, that was kind of a horror story.
Oh, just big changes.
In
big
and of itself. Yeah. You know, like an immediate change, an unannounced change last minute. But any other horror stories where you're just like, don't do this. Like, what can people do, actors or just people on set, to make the cinematographer's job easier?
Oh.
What would you say, like, don't, it could be producers, don't do this. actors, don't do this. I mean, that may, we maybe get into some dangerous territory with some of those requests.
Let me see.
PAs, don't do this. Directors, please never do this.
No, I mean, I think honestly, the biggest thing is just communication. Like, the biggest issues that I think I've had on set a lot of the time come from people being scared to just communicate that we don't have those lenses, we can't afford that light or those cameras or that dolly for the day or whatever. Like, I can deal with anything. Like, I'm totally fine with that. Trust me, I've made a music video or a short film or a feature with far less money than whatever we've got. So I'm not worried about doing it with less, but I do need to know that. Like, don't tell me that, you know, the morning that we're meant to shoot that scene, because that hasn't given me any time to problem solve and figure stuff out, you know? Whereas if you give me that communication early enough, anybody can pivot and figure out something. And 9 times out of 10, like, if you lose location, like, these things happen. Like, I've lost, like, there's a horror movie I did, Five Souls, where the whole thing's shot in a hospital. We lost the hospital the night before we started filming.
Oh my gosh.
So we ended up going back and calling one of the other ones that we had scouted, very different hospital, but we had scouted it, and we kind of, like, I mean, that said, when, you know, when we had scouted it, we had walked around it for an hour or two, like 2 weeks before, and suddenly we're like, oh, we're shooting in that one. I'm like, wow. Wait, which one of the 9 that we looked at is this? So, you know, kind of stuff changes. Stuff is always going to change. Yep. But if you, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, is that if you know the story and if you know the characters and you know what the essence was that you were trying to capture, it doesn't matter what's changed, because you just still know, oh, it's got to feel confined and it's got to feel this and that. Okay, so the room's changed, but how do we still make it feel that way? How do we?
Ed, we meet a lot of young people who are interested in becoming a cinematographer, filmmakers who really want to pursue that aspect. One of them actually is running our show right now. Noah over there running the
edit. Our intern Noah.
Waving furiously behind
us. Yeah, he has been like eating up this whole episode.
Absolutely.
I'm sure of it.
What are some like your top pieces of advice you could give people who are looking to pursue cinematography as their career?
Look, you're always gonna be learning, right? So don't be afraid to try things out. Don't be afraid to experiment. Learn from your mistakes. And the only people that are gonna know that it's a mistake is you. Like, 9 times out of 10, I've done stuff where it hasn't quite worked out, but everyone that's monitored, oh my God, that looks so good. And I'm like, that's not what I thought it was. They're like, oh, we love how this happened. And you're like, oh yeah, that was totally planned. So, you know, stuff happens, but like you are your own, or at least for me, I'm my own worst critic. Like I said earlier, it takes me 3 to 5 years to watch anything that I've shot and not absolutely hate it and kind of forget about everything and get back into it. So don't judge yourself too harshly. Don't judge yourself on somebody else's story and somebody else's pacing and their bookmarks and what achieves or what accolades they've been given.
Yeah.
Like, you can only run your race. Like, and I think it's very easy to kind of, you know, my friends and I call it going down the rabbit hole, where you watch other people, your friends or other people that you've just seen on Instagram that you know are kind of in your same sphere of network or whatever. Don't let that get to you. Like, be yourself, you know, and also be aware that you can't control anything in this industry. Like, don't take people on, you know, promises or on holds. Like, don't hold that over them. Don't hold it over Damien that he couldn't get me on that movie. He tried, he couldn't. You know, so just be honest to yourself. Stand up for what you can. And, I guess kind of be good to your word, because in this industry, that's all you can control is what you do and your word. Mm-hmm. So if you start with that integrity, I think you'll be pretty good from there.
It's been a common theme actually in several episodes that we've done, people telling us in whatever aspect, whether it be acting, producing, cinematography, you know, enjoy the journey, like learn from it. Be proud of it, you know, try not to compare yourself to other people. We've been hearing that from a bunch of our guests, which is pretty cool. And I think that it speaks to, you know, this, like why we're doing this podcast too, you know, like this was, we started it to tell people about our journey. Hope it inspires them. Hope it, you know, makes them feel like they can go make something with nothing.
Yeah.
I just think it's awesome. I think it's cool that you're continuing to emulate that in all of your, you know, your work and your projects that you're doing, even as you continue to grow.
Two things. Number one, I remember you telling us once on set that you never buy t-shirts. Is that true? Because you always just get them for free, right?
It's pretty common. Yeah, a lot of them are shoot t-shirts. I'm actually not wearing one today. But a lot of the times it's...
I'm going to do a shameless plug for Tremendum. And I'm going to give you a free t-shirt. So
I love it. I'll take it.
So the last Tremendum shirt he would have got was probably really old.
It was an older version.
It was really old. I honestly think I moved about 8 months ago and I had to throw out a bunch of crew t-shirts. And I may have thrown out my Tremendum t-shirt. So I'm glad I'm getting another one.
Ladies and gentlemen,
show that to the camera. Flash that to the camera.
Oh, right here.
You guys listening around, Travis is showing the shirt to the cameras here and presenting it to Ed Lucas.
I want you to have that.
I'm honored.
I want you to have that. The story on there is really cool. There's on the tag, there's like a little about Tremendum, what it means and who we are. And you're part of our story, man.
Yeah,
awesome,
dude.
Part of our story.
Fun times,
and
dude.
We love you. And I'm just trying to figure out what movie are we? Yeah, what are we gonna do?
We've got a whole bunch planned.
You want to do action? You want to do comedy? You want to do sci-fi? We can do horror. We've got a lineup of horror. But
sci-fi is fun. Action's really fun. We didn't even talk about the Bruce Willis movie. That was a crazy.
Which one was it?
So it's called Acts of Violence.
That's right.
That was nuts. So just to really quickly cover it, we had Bruce for one day and he was in 28 pages of the movie.
What?
Yeah. So we had to shoot him out of 28. So they were very kind. They gave us 2 hours of overtime that day. So we had 14 hours to shoot him out of 28 pages with four company moves.
Wow.
And it was gunfights, like car chases, throwing a UFC fighter off the roof. There was a ton of like sequences in it.
Was it Randy Couture? Was he the which was?
No, I'm going to butcher his name, so I'm not even going to try. But he was the heavyweight UFC champion of the world at that point. He was lovely guy.
Was he a Brazilian guy?
No, like Russian.
Russian guy. Oh, yeah. Krokop?
Something like that. Yeah, that's why I'm not trying to do this.
That's a tough dude.
It was, and he was lovely. He was amazing. We shot that in Cleveland. And I think in 14 hours, we did something like 86 setups with four company moves.
Jeez.
And all this stuff. It was
How big was the crew to pull that off?
We had two cameras. We couldn't afford more cameras. We had two cameras and I want to say I had maybe four grips, four electrics for that day. We definitely used some of our man days on that. But I mean, we basically were pre-lit four or five scenes in advance. We didn't have enough equipment to pre-light everything. So we were pre-lit maybe four or five scenes in advance. And as we finished one scene, they would wrap that scene and bunny hop it to the next one.
Wow.
And then by the end of the day, we had caught them up. So we walked into our last location as they were pre-lighting it as we were kind of getting in there and stuff. So
and how many insane. takes, how many takes did you guys get for these things?
Oh, like four takes a shot.
Four takes, and it's an action sequence, right? So it was.
I mean, some of them were action sequences, some of them were talking sequences, some of them. I mean, like literally, it spans the whole globe on that one. But
I don't know how you did it. That was a crazy one.
That was like really like one of those days where you're like, oh my god! And then by the end of it, you're just like, how did that just happen?
Yeah. And then Bruce Willis made more than the budget of the film.
Oh, yes. I'm sure. No, I mean, they have a very, that's done by one particular company. They have a very particular kind of pricing structure and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, but the thing too is that just by having him on for that one day and those 28 pages, the value of the movie jumped by millions of dollars.
Well, no, that's what, you know, and that's also why he has to be in 28 pages of the movie, because there's a contractual obligation that he has to be in with a certain amount to be able to put him on the box and the front cover and the page and all that kind of stuff. And everything else.
Interesting. That's interesting. Yeah.
So that was that's the other thing is that you get kind of, you know, as a cinematographer, you get away with not being a part of a lot of the politics.
Yeah,
but there's still
nice.
Certain politics which you've got to kind of go in for and you've got to make sure you get and you've got to play some of those games.
That is one aspect of being anyone but what we are that I do envy, not being involved in the politics, some of the legal stuff, some of that marketing, like the distribution and some of these aspects as filmmakers, as indie guys that we just have to deal with a lot.
As well as directors and writers and all that stuff we deal with.
It is all fascinating though. You know, like we complain and gripe about a lot of it, but it is all fascinating and we are blessed to be where we are and what we've been able to do and to grow and
what we have in the works to do. I mean, we've got a slate of like 7 films.
Amazing.
That we're actually working on getting a fund together for.
Awesome.
So we can do all of them.
Yep.
But then we've also got a couple ideas for TV shows too. And we'll show you one of them that we've already filmed something for.
Lucas up in there. DP.
But we'd love to have you DP some of these.
Dude, that'd be great fun. No, I'm always down. It'd be awesome to watch with you guys again.
Ed Lucas, everyone. This has been a super fun episode, catching up with Ed, talking about all the amazing stuff that you've been up to since 2013, maybe 14, since we last saw each other.
It's got to be about that.
Is there anything you want to say or anything? Any
final words of wisdom from Ed?
No. Oh God. Talk about being put on the spot. No, I don't think so. Let me be behind the camera.
Can
I get away from this now?
Put me where I'm comfortable.
Where can people find you if they want to follow your journey and
where you're on social media, anything like that?
The things you're doing.
Yeah, so I am on Twitter. I really do not use it. I'm better with pictures than I'm with words. You can check out my Instagram, Ed's Camera, EDDS Camera.
Awesome.
That's kind of where I try and do. I'm awful at it, honestly. I don't think I've posted for about a year. I need to post more.
You're better off not having posted.
That's a whole other thing is the social media thing. But no, I think because I've crossed over this boundary of like 30 odd features, I kind of want to do like 30 days with 30 features and maybe do some piece on that where I do a photo from every feature or a couple of photos from each feature and just talk about it and all that stuff. So
that's cool.
Something like that would be fun. But again, that's like a dream. I've got other stuff that I'm working on and other elements that I'm kind of playing with. So I like to kind of play on that side more than I do the social media side, honestly.
Yeah.
Any concepts or anything that like in terms of a story that you've come up with or strictly just working?
No, DP? There was a TV show that I helped a friend develop a little bit during lockdown, which was kind of an interesting thing to kind of get into that. But no, I get told that I should direct at some point and I have honestly very little desire to, at least at this point in my career. I like to support, directors and kind of add to the vision and kind of help facilitate and come up with like more to add to that. I don't think I'm going to be producing or trying to direct anything.
Just avoid that headache, man.
It's just not what I want to do.
I don't blame you.
I envy that sentiment. Yeah.
Well, Ed Lucas, everyone, this has been a fun episode. Follow Ed on social media, check his stuff out, watch some of his movies. He's got a bunch you can go look up and check out, including The Gallows.
Yes.
Another shameless plug.
I'm excited that you're here. This is great. Anyway, follow him at EDDS Camera on Instagram. What a great episode, guys. Yep. Cinematography, directors of photography, just such a neat way of telling stories. And it's great to have you on. So
Yep. Join us next time, guys, on another episode of Unlikely Story. Thanks for being here.